Hi, I'm Jesse. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 23rd of 2007, which was just in time to ruin Christmas or not ruin Christmas, depending on how you look at it. And I have a sponsor, Ivy, who I think some of you know. And yay, I love her too. And my home group's the Midtown group, and I am from Reston, so it was actually a really nice drive down here. And thank you for asking me to speak. I'm sorry I couldn't come on the week you wanted, but hopefully this will work too. So in a general way, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and I know your email specifically said, what am I able to do today that I wasn't able to do before, which is a whole host of things, but we only have an hour. And so I didn't come out of the womb drinking. I did, as far as I know, have a normal childhood, nothing to blame it on, nothing like that. I remember the first lie I ever told. It was about Care Bears. It was very obvious. I blamed something I had done on Care Bears. I remember feeling very successful about it. I really thought that my mom had believed me. And from my childhood until I was about 13, everything was fine. I was a high achiever. I had an older sibling. I had two younger siblings. And really, as far as anybody could have looked at my life, it was really pretty ideal. And when I was in high school, I developed a really, really awful eating disorder, which is neither here nor there, but it comes into play because it's how I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, actually. And what happened was, I started having with this eating disorder in high school, and I started dating this guy who just happened to be at this school drunk, which is awesome that we can find each other even then. And I had my first drink, and I found out how comfortable drinking made me, because I don't know if anybody's had experience with an eating disorder, but it's a very isolating thing, and it's a very controlling thing, and it's a very shame-based thing. And alcohol made me, I didn't know you could be that effing comfortable, and it was just fabulous. And I graduated high school a year earlier, and I went to George Washington for my freshman year of college, and this is so stupid, so you can judge me, but I know it's stupid. I was living in a room with six other girls, and I was stupid. I was the only one who wasn't Jewish. They call it GW for a reason. And I felt different, and it was something very, like, they had all of the right material items, and they all went to, like, I don't know, temple together, and I felt very much an outsider in this, this really great institution. And I started drinking, like, all the time, and I just took to it. And there were liquor stores that are used to college students, and they'll serve to you if you can walk through the door straight. And, I discovered drinking in the morning. That was, like, amazing. And drinking before classes, and then just not going to classes and just drinking. And, you know, that we, it was awesome. And I still had the eating disorder at the time, and I was going to a therapist, and I started telling her how much more comfortable I was getting at this school, and she's like, oh, what do you think the difference is? And I was like, I started drinking, and it's been great. And she immediately told me I need to go to AA or she'd stop seeing me. And I was like, really? Like, there's nothing, I'm doing the same thing everybody else is doing, so I stopped seeing her. And it really made sense to me. And what ended up happening was rather than failing all my classes, I am a great manipulator. When I knew that I was about to be failing, rather than take an F or take a withdrawal failing, I threw myself in the mercy of the dean, and I said, oh, I've got this terrible eating disorder, and I've got this depression, and I really need help. And so they gave me a clean pass. I got a withdrawal passing for all of my classes, and some I just got straight withdrawal without any type of penalty. And that was the first half of freshman. Then the second half of freshman year, I made it to my first 2 weeks of classes, and I went to the library at night, I did really good, and then I started drinking again, and I just didn't go to class the rest of the semester. So come the end of the semester, I knew that I knew that my parents were going to wonder, because they knew everything that had happened at the end of the first semester. And so, I did basically the same thing. I threw myself on the mercy of a different dean, and I got a clean pass. I'm really good at, I can put on the innocent face and the very, like, open my eyes real wide and cry real hard, and I got a free pass. Only this time there was, like, an attachment where I had to go to rehab, but the rehab that I was sent to was not for alcoholism, it was for eating disorders, because that's what I was telling everybody that the issue was. And while I was at my intake at this rehab, because it was an eating disorder clinic, they wanted to see, like, your weekly diet. And I'd never been to rehab before. I didn't know you were supposed to lie. And so I did an honest intake. And it was like Monday, apple, can of tuna fish, fifth of vodka. Tuesday, apple, piece of bread, fifth of scotch. Like, it was a pattern. And she said to me, she said, "You see a pattern. It's not the apple." And so they sent me, that was my, the reason I bring that, that's how I got to AA the first time. I was 18 years old. I was, I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I wasn't interested in stopping drinking because I thought that was a little excessive and really not even an issue. And I knew that I had an eating disorder. I was okay with that. And I could see that that was causing problems financially and with my teeth. But otherwise, I went to this rehab really as the same reason I went to almost every other rehab. I went to this rehab because it was a get-out-of-jail-free card. Not free for my parents, but free for me. And so I did 6 weeks at this rehab up in Pennsylvania, and I went to two AA meetings while I was there, and it was about eight women. We went to women's meetings. It was like eight women in the back of a church, and I was 18, and they all seemed like they were ancient. They were probably in their 30s, which I'm 31 now, so that's awful. But it was really boring, and someone got a bookmark. I've never seen this one, but someone got a bookmark for having 8 months sober. And the second time I went there, someone called on me to share, and I had learned how to share in rehab at this point. And so I had this, I'm sure, very eloquent, I am an alcoholic, I am surrendered, share, where people came up to me afterwards and hugged me and said, "It's going to be okay," like, you know, and I left there never really thinking another thing about it. But then my aftercare for this rehab was to go to an outpatient program that was for alcohol, not for eating disorders. And I went there, I think, for like 8 weeks, and I started drinking about 4 weeks after that. And that was, so those 6 weeks that I was in the rehab and then about 4 weeks after was for the next 10 years, really the longest, not 10, for the next like 8 years, really the longest period of time I had sober. I think I got roughly, I want to say like 67 days. And then 4th of July came around and 4th of July. And that was basically, you could repeat that for the next, until I was 24, I'm not good at math. But for the next 6 years, you could repeat that. It was Jesse drinks. Jesse's family has a crisis because I do something or something happens, and so I get sent to rehab. And so between the ages of 18 and 24, I went to 26 different rehabs because my parents didn't know what else to do. Rehab / detoxes. I went to like four of those were detoxes. And then there was another sprinkling of psych wards. And so I had exposure to AA, and my train of thought was, if AA was going to work, I had had, like, the best in the country exposure to it, and it would have worked because I knew everything, clearly, and I could recite the steps to you, and I could even, you know, I'd done a fourth step, and not an honest one. I'd done a fourth keywords there, and I had had all this exposure, and I was like, well, if AA was going to work, it would have worked. Like, I really was under the impression that it was osmosis. And like it would seep in at some point. And you know, I'd been on Anabuse and whatever that, I forget, there was another one that like turns off the alcohol receptors, and I'd been on that, and I found out that if you just threw up after you took it, it was fine. eating disorders came in handy then. And you know, it was a constant cycle, and I really, during that time, you know, I had an older sister who went away to college, and so she kind of escaped a lot of it. But then my younger siblings had to live in the terror that was my household, and which consisted of locks on all the doors because I would steal anything, I had to sleep in bed between my parents, which was awkward. And they, like, and then there were some nights where I would try to wiggle down between them. And so I did that a couple times and would sneak out. And so they had to start hanging Christmas bells on the doors to make sure that I wasn't leaving. And I would just disappear. And every time, after about 3-4 days, when it was, like, constant round-the-clock drinking, and you wake up at, like, 3 in the morning, and you go steal a piece of mail to get your address, and I'd call my parents, and they'd come pick me up. And then I'd be back in rehab a couple days later. And that was our life for most of my early 20s. And I knew it was a problem. I knew it was problematic. I knew that I was hurting people and that I was causing a lot of strain in my family. And I cared. I genuinely cared. But I also had the complete inability to stay stopped. And I would go to rehab with these really great resolves, and I would start out real. I'm a really good starter. I would start out really good in whatever rehab I was in, be it like Father Martin or Hazelden or, you know, Karen, wherever I happened to be at that time, and then I would either start lying or I would start having eating disorder again, or I would get into a relationship. Those are like my three big things, and I found that if I got into a relationship in rehab, why would I do any of the work? I've got a new addiction. And this is basically, it was the same with the food. If I was, you know, why do I need help? Because I'm finding a way to make myself feel better, which is what alcohol does. It just makes me feel so good. And every time I would get out of rehab, I would drink again, usually with whatever guy that I'd gotten together with while I was in there. Because for a lot of my drinking, I was under 21. Not a lot of it, but for about half of it. And life was pretty terrible for my parents. And a couple times after I got out of rehab, I would pull myself together and I would get a job or I would go back to school. I went to 4 different colleges during this time. I don't know why they kept taking me, but they did. And I would go to different colleges. I went to Mary Washington for a little while. And while I was at Mary Washington, I managed to pull it together for a semester. And I still don't know how I did it, but I got into the habit of drinking in the morning. And part of my controlling my alcoholism was that I had signed up for a 7 a.m. tennis class. You have to follow me on this one because it really does make sense. And so I'd wake up around 3 in the morning with, like, the shakes real bad, and I'd lay in bed until 6 o'clock. I would make myself lay in bed. I wouldn't get up because that was alcoholic. And so if I'd stay in bed until 6, and then I'd take a few shots of whatever I had to get my hands steady, and then I would go to tennis, and I would play. I'm terrible at sports, actually, but when I've got alcohol in my system, I'll just do it. And so I'd like sweat out all the alcohol, and I'd go to the rest of my classes for the day, because I would. I don't know if that's getting, like, if I'd be sober, but I would have sweat so much alcohol out of my, because I also sweat like a pig when I'm drinking for whatever reason. And I would sweat so much out of my system that I had the clarity to be able to get to classes, and that's a lot of how I got through that semester. But what ended up happening was the end of that semester, I was 22 at the time, the end of that semester I went home for Christmas break, and I didn't have, all of my control pieces were gone for how I was controlling my drinking. And I had a few huge blowouts with my parents, and so I came back to school early and just started drinking with, like, just no restriction whatsoever. And I ended up stealing a gun from my friend who, I don't know why he had a gun, but he had a gun. Stole a gun from my friend, and I took it to his car, and I called my mom. And, I'm drunk at the time, and it's, like, 11 in the morning. And I call my mom, and I'm like, called to say goodbye, told her I was killing myself, and she's like, as far as she knows, I'm sober, so she's blown out of the water. We'd had these fights because I was home and not drinking, and just really a bitch, and so she gets this phone call from me, and I'm going to kill myself, and the next thing that happens, I had the gun in my hand, I was in the passenger seat, my arm was on the windshield, or my elbow was on the windshield, and then my elbow slipped and the gun went off and it blew off a bunch of my hair. And I went silent because a gun had just gone off near my ear. They're very loud. And my mom thought I was dead because the phone had gone silent. She'd heard a gunshot. And the next thing I remember, I don't remember the cops coming. I don't remember anything, but I woke up in the hospital. I was in restraints. I had like IVs in my arm. There was a cop sitting outside the door because apparently I was on suicide watch for good reason. And that's what my mom's life was like for many years. And how do you make amends for that? And that's how my life was. And that was not my only suicide attempt. I did have some suicide attempts that were like get out of jail free cards, or it was just a threat. But I did have a couple other ones too, you just get to that point where you're just like, I'd wake up in the morning, I'd be like, I'm not going to drink today. I remember I'd try to look my eyes in the mirror, and then I'd end up drinking at some point that day. And what ended up happening for me, the last, 6 months of my drinking was, I was in school at George Mason, and every day that I would come home, I would get breathalyzed, and I would get completely patted down and searched. And because I used to try to sneak, miniatures in, or I'd drink while I was on campus, and it was just a prison. I mean, it was, for my parents, for me, it was just kind of, it was what I was used to, so it was fine. It was annoying, but it was fine. And what ended up happening is my parents went to Jamaica. My older sister came home from college to watch me. I'm 24 at the time. She has to babysit me. Because my parents are gone and my sister wasn't breathalyzing me, I went out and got drunk. I came home. She and I got into a fist fight. My parents happened to call from Jamaica in the middle of the fight. She told them what was going on. They called Fairfax County Police from Jamaica. Fairfax County Police showed up and arrested me. And I had been to AA meetings with my home group by this point. My parents had been dropping me off at meetings for a while. I had an experience where I was drinking rubbing alcohol because I didn't have anything else. And I had not made the mistake, but I had actually, for some reason, I'd gone to a counseling appointment drunk. When I'm drunk, I either can be more of a liar or more honest. It's a toss-up. And I had told the counselor about drinking rubbing alcohol, and so she had told my parents, because I guess it wasn't privacy if you're, hurting yourself or something. So my parents, they were just kind of at their end, and when all this happened with the arrest, I got arrested for assault. I don't remember if it was assault and battery. I don't really know what the difference is. But I was arrested, taken to jail, and I had been going to meetings with my home group during this time, and I even had a sponsor at that point, I think. And I called her from jail. I called her as I was walking home from the jail. And she said, well, it sounds like you better pray. And I was like, are you effing kidding me? You're not going to offer to come pick me up. You're not going to, tell me it's going to be okay, or, pat me on the back, or, anything. It was just, you better pray, or something like that. And I hung up on her. And I went home, and I stole a bottle of wine from 7-Eleven as I was walking home, and I, wrenched up one of those open house signs, and I used that to get it open. That was one of my last drinks. My parents got home the next day, and they kicked me out, and it was the very best thing that they ever could have done. All of the letting me back in, where I am a parent, I can't imagine what that would be like to kick your kid out. But all the letting me back in, it just kept giving me a place to go. It kept giving me a place to run to. And when they kicked me out, I literally had nowhere to go but to a sober person's house. I mean, I could have. I had choices. I could have gone downtown. I could try to live off the street. I could have gone to a homeless shelter. I could have gone to a drinking friend's house, because I just still did have some. But I went to an AA person's house because my parents offered to give me a ride to this person's house, and she said, you can come. And I did go, and that was in 2006, which is not my sobriety date. My sobriety date's in 2007. And while I was staying with her, I got an honest sobriety date. I did have a few more drinks, drinking episodes while I was there, but I did come to a point where I reached the bottom, and I got a new sponsor, Susan. I got Susan Gray as a sponsor, and I did a fourth and fifth step, and I got involved in service, and I wrote an eighth step. I didn't do anything for my ninth step, but I wrote the eighth step, and I stopped. So just, that was it. I was done. And what happened at the time was my sponsor got very sick, and she ended up going to a psych ward, and I got very resentful, and I that resentment really became my higher power. It was someone to blame. It was somebody to be actively angry at. And I love strong emotion. It's not good for me, but I love it. And so to be angry at someone, and I had found another person in our home group to feed this resentment with me, and I would call her, and I would bitch, and I would, you know, I would, oh, yeah, can you believe she did? And at the end of the day, she stayed sober, and I drank. And what ended up happening was I got a scholarship to go to Cambridge for a semester over in England, and while I was in England, the first day that I got there, I went to a meeting, and then the second day, I decided I didn't really need to go, because the truth was, I hadn't been sponsored for a couple months. I hadn't been helping anybody, and I'd been lying about going to meetings. I was still going to, like, the big meetings that you get seen at, but I wasn't really going to meetings the other days of the week. And so I went to England, and was really out of sight, out of mind, and I just, it was hell. They have these places called Thrashers, which are basically like ABC stores, and they're not closed on Sundays, and they deliver. And it was just, I don't know, I'm surprised I came home from England alive. And this is the hard part. I came home from England and had to pretend that I had been sober in England. And that was terrible, because everybody's asking about my experience in England. I'm feeding them all this bullshit, and, you know, oh, it was great. No, I went to these meetings, and, you know, you're just making up stuff as you go along, but then you have to remember everything that you've made up. And I was able to live on the bullshit and detox white knuckle for about 3 weeks, and then I had to drink. And I figured, this is my thought process, because all of my friends were in AA at this time. My boyfriend was in an AA. I lived in a sober house. All of my friends were in AA. There was no way I could get honest, because then everybody would think badly about me. I didn't think that there was any way that I could get honest. And so I figured, okay, well, I controlled it in England, because I stopped. In my head, I had stopped again. And so I worked downtown, and I started drinking just like in the middle of the day, and then I would go home and take a nap and go to meetings at night, which was very uncomfortable. I mean, it's just so uncomfortable, and you just try not to talk to anybody. And that was able to last for about a week, because then you wake up from your nap, and you can't not drink again. I don't know if that makes sense, but drinking in the middle of the day and then not drinking at night, it was really hard. It was awful. So I was able to do that for like a little while, and then it was drinking at night. And then I had to come up with a story for why I wasn't going to meeting at night. So I made up like this ridiculous illness. And this good pigeon sister of mine, she and my mom came over to my house, and they're like, oh my God, she's really sick. Because I was passed out. I was passed out underneath my bed. I don't know why. But it was, I was passed out underneath my bed. And they're like, they're trying to pull it back. They're going to take me to the ER. They think I'm dying of some disease. And as she's pulling my purse out, out tumbles a bottle of Aristocrat. And it was like, oh, well, there it is. And and that was, so I went to the hospital. I don't think I went to the psych ward that time. I think I just detoxed in the emergency room. And I did a fourth and fifth step with my sponsor, and I left off that I had slept with someone while I was in England, because I had a boyfriend at the time back here in America. I'd gotten honest with her that I had drank in England, but I did not get honest about everything. And so from then on, every conversation with her was a lie, because every conversation after that, she would say, is there anything else you need to tell me? And I'd say no, which basically makes the entire conversation a lie. And I was able to stay sober for 4 months that time. And what ended up happening was the beginning of December, I just got way resentful all over again. One big part of that was because I hadn't done an honest fourth and fifth step. But I also hadn't surrendered. Like, I hadn't ever really accepted that that I was truly powerless. Because in my head, I had still controlled it in England. I had been able to stop when it was time to come home. And so middle of December, I was going to go drink for, like, one night. And I really, really thought that I was going to go drink for one night. And I told somebody that I was going to my grandmother's with my dad. I think I told my parents I was going to somebody else's house. So they went check on me. And the person that I had been with in England met me in D.C., and we stayed drunk there for 2 days. I think I texted a roommate that I was going to stay in New Jersey at my grandmother's for a night longer. And I drove home from D.C. on the GW. I drove home, I don't know if anybody knows the GW Parkway, but it's my first experience driving. It was drunk, and it was, oh, you grip the steering wheel, just hope you don't hit anybody. And I really felt like, okay, I'm going to get home, and I'm not going to drink. And I got home, and I'm pacing in the house, and the very first thing I did was go to the liquor store, because nobody was home, and you're with all your thoughts, and you don't know, it's like, God, how am I going to fix this situation? How am I going to get out of this one? So I just went to the liquor store. And I managed to stay drunk for about 2 days in the house by dodging all my roommates. And I would hide water, I would put the liquor in a water bottle, like, before I'd get to the house, or at least I thought I had. And I would wake up in the morning, and first thing I would do is, like, either down the side of my bed or underneath my pillow, I would go for the water bottle. I'd go, and I had a mirror in my room, and I'd go, and I'd stand in front of the mirror, and I couldn't meet my eyes in the mirror. And I would start chugging the vodka, and then slowly I'd be able to meet my eyes in the mirror, and it was just despairing. It was sad, it was pathetic, it was all those awful words. And I really felt very trapped. I was like, this is just how it's going to be. Like, this is it. This is just how it's going to be. But at the same time, I would have that thought coupled with the thought is, this is going to be the last day. Last time we're going to do this. We're going to get through the morning. We're going to get rid of, you know, we'll dump out the rest. And what happened is I stopped. The only way I ever stopped is I got caught. I don't know if anybody knows Chris Dugan, but he called me, and they used to babysit for his children, and he called me, and there weren't many people that I was talking to at that point, but he called me, and I called him back assuming that he wanted me to watch his kids, and I said, oh, hey, Chris, sorry, I missed your call, and he said, oh, Jesse, so it's like order detox, and my first reaction was to lie. I was like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about, I don't know what you're talking about, and he's like, well, we found all your bottles in the garbage, so it's like order detox, and I just said, come get me. Because I had been caught, and it was the best thing in the world. But I'd been caught by somebody who wasn't judgmental or condemning. It was just very matter of fact. And he said, we'll be there in about 15 minutes. And in those 15 minutes, I chugged everything that I had, because that seemed to make sense. I don't know why. And I was physically incapable of pouring anything out. So I was coding when they got there. Because there was still a lot there, and like my eyes had rolled back, and apparently I wet somebody's couch, which is always fun, and I get reminded of it every time I see him, and so we went to Fairfax County Hospital, and I woke up at about 3 in the morning, saw my parents out in the corridor, no cop outside the door this time, so I knew it wasn't that bad in my head, and I was so pug-fuggled. I was just like, what happened? Like, I was going to drink for one night. Like, this is one night of drinking, and here it is 4 days later. And I was, the confusion and that was the most powerless that I have ever, there's been one other time in my sobriety that I have felt that powerless. But it was really a sense of, what happened? Like, I had such a good plan. And really, that was the first time that I ever felt like, that I really had this disease and that I really came to understand what it really means, that I cannot stop drinking once I stop and I do not know what's going to happen. And so I called a couple people and I was like, I'm too sick for AA. I remember saying that to a couple people, like, I am too sick for AA. I've had exposure to the best doctors. If this was going to work for me, it would have. I have been to the best programs and the best meetings. If this was going to work for me, it would have. I did not see this as a solution that was going to work in my life. And someone told me to call this woman Ivy. And I knew Ivy. Ivy had taken my inventory for me a couple times, so I didn't like her. And it's not that I didn't like her. I don't like anybody telling me when I'm wrong or pointing out my bad behavior. And the one thing that I knew about Ivy and that I desperately wanted was that she had a belly laugh. Like, she had the ability to laugh at something, and it seemed like she was laughing with her whole body and ate, like, just a lot of joy in that. And that was, I hadn't done that in a very long time. There were things that I had found funny, but to find an actual joy in something was, I didn't have that. And so I called Ivy, and it was about 3 in the morning, and the she didn't have my number in her phone. And so she answered, and she's like, "Hey, what's going on?" I said, "Oh, it's Jessie. I drank. I'm in the hospital. You know, will you sponsor me?" And she was like, hold on, what are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm taking out my catheter. Will you sponsor me?" And she starts laughing, because you can't take out a catheter. I didn't know that. I was trying to. And she starts laughing. And I took her laughing as meaning that she wouldn't sponsor me. And I was like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to bother you. Okay, go back to sleep." She was like, "No, stupid. Like, yes, I'll sponsor you. Stop pulling on that. You're going to hurt yourself." And that was the beginning of our relationship. And she picked me up the next day, and she took me to go get my big book out of my house. She wouldn't let me get anything else. She dropped me off with my parents. And I had these secrets that I needed to tell her, and it took me 2 days to tell her. My last drinking day was, or my sobriety date was December 23rd. So on Christmas, I went to a meeting that was on the fifth step, and I kept hearing, your secrets will keep you sick, and if you don't get completely honest, like, you're screwed. You don't have a chance here. And so I was, after the meeting, I grabbed her husband, and I was like, "Is Ivy home? I need to talk to her." And he was like, "Yeah, call her." And so I got in the car with my friend Rachel, because I didn't feel like I could share these things by myself. I was too ashamed, too afraid, whatever it is. And I turned to Rachel and I was like, "Okay, before I call Ivy, I want you to know what I'm going to tell her." And Rachel starts laughing because I had told her everything when I was drunk in the hospital. she was like, "Those are your secrets? Like, come on." And so I called Ivy and I told her, and she said, "Okay, is there anything else?" I said, "No, there's actually not." And I meant it, and it was very freeing. It was like, "No, like, that's actually everything." She's like, "All right, well, I'll pick you up tomorrow, and we'll get started on your fourth step, or on your second step," because that was my first step for now. And so I went the next night. I went to her house, and we sat and we read through the second step. And her husband was in the room, and I thought that was very weird that he was in the room. I was like, "We're talking about God. Shouldn't he be like these?" I thought it was a shame thing. I was like, "We're talking about God. Like, shouldn't he be somewhere else?" As if he didn't understand or you know, hadn't been through this. And I really did think, I was like, "Why is he in here?" And you know, we went through the second and third step, and she explained to me willingness. And in that moment, all I wanted was to feel comfortable. And Ivy told me that her comfort was based on a higher power. Or I don't know if that's what she said. That's what I heard. And I don't know what she said. But that was enough for me. I wanted that, and I was willing to listen to this woman, because for whatever reason, she seemed to know what I was talking about. My secrets didn't scare her off, and I knew that she was working this program, and that she said that this program made her comfortable, or made her, you know, allowed her to stay comfortable sober. And that was my willingness, was, okay, if you say this is going to work for you, then I'm going to put my faith in, I really put my faith in her. I was like, I'm going to trust you that this is going to work. And that worked for a while. That worked, that got me through my fourth. I did a fourth and fifth step within my first 2 weeks sober, because I had to. There was no waiting, and I didn't even want to. And I had done a couple fourth and fifth steps before, but this one was it was not the format in the book. It was just a list of questions, and it was very, very detailed. And I gave her everything. And I know you're supposed to sit for an hour afterwards, but Ivy said, "Go sit for as long as you want." And she left me in her bedroom, and she went out with her family, and I sat for like 4 minutes, and I came bounding out of her bedroom. I was like, "I'm done." And she was like, "You don't want to sit anymore?" And I felt such relief from getting completely honest with somebody. And she was like, "Well, go play with my daughter then," because she wasn't ready for me yet. And so I went and I played with her daughter for a while. And then I think maybe within 2 months I did an eighth step, and I started work on my ninth step. And I wasn't in a place to make amends to my family because I hadn't changed enough. But I was in a place to make amends to, like, high school roommates, or excuse me, college roommates, and a couple other people that had been in my life. And, you know, love or hate Facebook, I found almost all of my college roommates on Facebook and was able to get in touch with them all over the country and made amends to all of them. And so I started getting service positions at meetings. I was going to meetings on a regular basis. I was gainfully employed. I was paying my own rent. My parents weren't paying it anymore. And I really started to get my feet planted in AA. I'm still fallible. Not that this is a fallible thing, but I am still the same person. When I was 14, 15 months sober, I found out I was pregnant, which is awesome. And it was not planned. It was really a big shock to both me and the father. And this was someone I'd been dating for about a little under a year. And it was awful. It was, I was ashamed. I thought there was no way I could do this. I had no intention of marrying this person because I didn't really even like him anymore. And I think it also carried me through the next year because it was over the next 9 months that I actually got a higher power, like a genuine, my own higher power, not going through the actions of anybody else and not running on service steam or meeting steam or working with newcomer steam. This was a higher power for myself and based on my own real pain. And when I found out I was pregnant, my sponsor said, well, it's time to make amends to your parents because you got to clear the roads and, bigger things are coming. And so I did. I made amends to all my family, to all my two sisters, my brother, and my parents. I made face-to-face amends with them. And about a week after that, I had to tell my parents that I was pregnant. And they were thrilled, which I was shocked. I thought they'd be furious. And they were thrilled, and the guy and I moved in together, and the next year was probably the worst year, one of the worst years of my life. Even on top of, not worse than any of my drinking experiences, but it was terrible. And the only reason I didn't drink was because I was pregnant. This guy became my higher power. I was determined that he had to marry me, otherwise I wasn't okay. If he didn't marry me, it meant that I was bad, I was wrong, I was not good enough. And it was awful. And I must have done like four fourth and fifth steps during that time. One of my best friends had gotten pregnant and she got married. And I thought, of course she did, because I'm the worst person in the world and I'm not worth it. I'm not worthy of anything. I'm going to be branded the rest of my life. And I had the baby in October of 2009, and I was completely unable to enjoy being a parent because I was so consumed with resentment at this man, coupled with him being my higher power, which was a very sick thing, but it's what it was. And when I was when the baby was about 4.5 months old, he kicked us out of the apartment. He said we couldn't live there anymore, And so I moved back in with my parents, and it was, I think I spent the next 2 weeks in bed. I couldn't get out of bed. I thought there was no way I could get through this. Nobody else had ever gone through this before. There were no other single mothers in America. And I was ashamed, and we were members of the same home group, and I just knew everybody was going to take his side. And the only reason that I didn't drink during that time was because I was nursing. And I was like, well, I'm not going to get the baby drunk. And I got a higher power in my bed one night. It was like 3 a.m. and I walked out to my parents' kitchen. I was just kind of pacing. I knew I couldn't fall asleep because I was having racing thoughts. But I also knew that, my parents had stuff in their... My parents didn't have any liquor in the house. They just hadn't for a long time. But they had medicine, and they had drugs. Not, like, crack, but they had, you know, like Tylenol PM, or Robitussin. And I had drank Robitussin to get messed up before. I drank Robitussin before I drank rubbing alcohol because I thought that the Robitussin was kind of steroid. I was like, okay, it'll coat my throat so the rubbing alcohol won't burn. and I'd gotten really messed up from it. So I thought, okay, well, I'll just drink the Robitussin, and I will go to sleep, and then I will go to sleep, because I was so tired, I was so exhausted, I was crying nonstop. I just had a baby, so part of that's that, but I'm also a sick alcoholic, so part of it's that, too. I was a sick alcoholic going through a breakup with a new baby, so lots going on, and the only reason I didn't drink that night, because it would have been drinking, even though I could have justified it as, okay, I needed to sleep for my sanity and for my health, it would have been drinking, it would have been taking the medicine to change the way that I feel, which really would have been using whatever the object was, it would have been using, because it would have been taking something to change me. And I texted my sponsor that night, and I was like, I want to drink this Robitussin, I do, And I texted both Ivy and Joyce that night, and Joyce told me to imagine myself in the palm of God's hand, and that nothing could hurt me while I was there. And I was like, that is retarded. But I did it. I did a visual in my head, and I made myself focus on it, and I prayed, and I calmed down, and I fell asleep. And I woke up, and I was ready. I woke up, and I was ready to deal with everything. And I really did feel like, I don't know how to force that experience. I don't know how to manufacture that experience. It came when it came, but it came because I kept asking for help and because I didn't take a drink. If I had taken that first drink, I wouldn't have been able to have that experience. And I woke up the next morning. I was still a mess, but I was in a different mental frame. I was like, I felt like things were going to be okay, and that I was going to get through this. And over the next year, we got involved in a really nasty custody thing. It was awful. The baby was, you know, he was still nursing. He was only like 5 to 6 months old at that time. So I had custody. I still have custody. But it was just awful. And I was paranoid to go to my home group meetings because he was a part of the home group. And he trash-talked me a lot. I had direction to keep my mouth shut about him, so I did. I was allowed to talk about him with my sponsor and 5 women, and that was it. And I did. And I think that's why I'm still comfortable in those meetings today. It took some time, but, you know, during that time, I redid a bunch of the steps with my sponsor, and I, especially 6 and 7, because it was, I did a real flush inventory of what had really gone on during that relationship, because I had to stop blaming him. And It was a really dark time, but it was a really great time, and I began to enjoy being a mother. I was able to show up for my son. I was able to show up for my family. When I moved back in with my parents, I used to work down on Capitol Hill, and I had to give up my job down on Capitol Hill because it was like an hour and a half commute, and with the baby, it just wouldn't have worked. And so I was home for a while, And I kept thinking, actually, because I was getting, every time I would have an interaction with the father, usually at a transfer or over email, I would go white hot with rage. And it was fear. It was because of fear, and I know that. But it was every interaction. It was like this. Like, just, you know, bad word. Like, just, and it was livid with rage every time. And the only reason that I didn't drink then, or at least I kept thinking, was the only reason I wasn't going to drink then was because I didn't want to lose custody. And I thought if I drank, I would lose custody. And I'll be damned if that, you know, motherfucker's going to win. And so that was my motivation for a little while. But I didn't drink. And we got through the custody thing in March of 2010, or March of 2011. We settled all our custody. We have signed, you know, we didn't have to have a court date that day. We settled the morning of court. And it is a fair and balanced custody. He sees his dad every Wednesday at 5 to Thursday at 5, and then every other weekend from Friday at 5 until Monday at 10, and I don't like it. Like, I don't like it, but I do know that it is fair and it is just, and that makes it okay for me. And he has taken me back to court 13 times since then. And every time it is a real test. He hasn't won a single time, but every time I get in fear, and there have been times where I let the fear win, and I become a raging bitch to all those around me, and there are times when I have faith, and I get through it with grace and dignity, and it's just been a mixed bag. I wish I could do better. I wish it could be 100% getting through it well, And I went back to school to get my master's in education, and I just this past summer I went back to work. I teach preschool now, and I have my son is in my school with me. He just turned 3, and I just got married about a month ago. Not to the father, to someone else. And it's still a challenge. My life is really great, and I'm able to be a wife. I'm able to be a daughter. My sister was my maid of honor. My sister who hated me, who would turn and run from a room if she even saw that I was in it, was my maid of honor. And, you know, my parents said the wedding was just, it was so happy, and it was so filled with joy. And it's just been, sobriety has not been easy, because life happens. I don't know that I have a plan until I don't get my way, and then it's holy fuck. But it's like things are bumpy, and I don't get to many meetings anymore, and that's really the hardest part, because I have to really actually work to stay connected. We have a clause in our contract about meetings, and that he can't ever be around anything AA, which is really unfortunate, but that's the way that it is for right now. And so I go to meetings when I don't have my son. So some weeks I get to about 5 meetings, and some weeks I only get to 2, or some weeks I only get to 1 or 2. And that's been really hard, because when I'm away from AA meetings, I can fall into the delusion that I'm normal and that I don't need to come. Even though I talk to my sponsor probably 6 days a week, I don't know why I don't always call her on both days on the weekend. I give myself a free pass for some reason, but even though I talk to my sponsor, I do have new women in my life pretty constantly. I don't have any service positions, and that's something that my sponsor and I had to figure out what to do. I find ways to be of service at meetings, but because I have a different schedule every week, I couldn't. It was a toss up of what to do with that. And so rather than having service positions at meetings, I have service at events, or I find ways to be of service when I'm at a meeting. I don't know when that's going to change. Hopefully at some point when I can get a consistent schedule. And the only real thing that I think has saved me throughout everything is that prayer. I've never lost prayer. Even when things were really, really awful and when I really thought that I'm not going to get through this, I always prayed in the morning and I prayed at night. And there's been lots of times when I've prayed throughout the day. Whenever I'd go into court, I'd pray. But for the most part, I always ask for help in the morning to stay sober, and at the end of the day, I always say thank you. And I thank God for everything he's given me and for everything that he's taken away. Even if that doesn't make sense to me at the time, those have always been consistent, and I don't think that that's a coincidence, because there's been a lot of situations in my life that a drink sounds like a really good idea. And it doesn't have to be a bad thing. The breakup, that would have been a great reason to drink, but then my wedding would have been a great reason to drink. But it doesn't have to be bad. I like to drink it, whatever. It's okay. And I don't discriminate. And so, you know, I would like to die sober. That would be awesome. But I can't even think about that because I just freaked out in my head about it. Wait. But, you know, today I'm at a meeting, and that's awesome. And I'm being of service because I'm participating in the meeting. And I talked to my sponsor today, and I called 2 new girls. The new girl that was supposed to come with me today is drunk, so that's unfortunate. But it's also okay because I got to come. And I heard her. She was ashamed to come. She's like, I can't go if I'm drunk. I was like, you have no idea how many meetings I've been to drunk. It's fine. But I understand that, too, and I didn't have to pressure her, and I got to remain friendly and non-judgmental. Because that's how people were with me, and if people had judged me for drinking in an AA meeting, why would I come back? Where else am I going to go? And I have no idea what time it is because I don't have my glasses on. But, okay, 3 minutes, okay. I'm actually going to wrap it up because I just cut myself off. So thank you so much.